From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. This show is heard on radio stations around the world, including 103.7 CFBU St. Catharines, Ontario, and 107.9 WRFA Jamestown, New York. I'm John Steinman, and I'll be with you for the next hour. On today's broadcast, we listen in on an exciting and celebratory event that took place in Nelson, British Columbia back in September of this year, 2008. For those of you regular listeners who have been following the evolution of the Nelson Creston Community Supported Grain Project and our local Grain Revolution series, what perhaps was the climax for the project's first year success was an event hosted over a weekend to celebrate the monumental harvest of grain that took place just weeks earlier. The event was hosted to showcase the project as being a catalyst for what event organizers call a local food revolution. The event was called the Kootenai Harvest Revival, and on today's broadcast and into next week, we'll listen in on recordings from the event, which for today will include musician Bessie Wapp, Master of Ceremonies and co-founder of Capers Markets, Russell Precious, spokesperson for the Senaikst Nation, author and historian Eileen Delahanty Perks, and representing the Dukabor communities of the interior of British Columbia, J.J. Verrigan. Well, before we listen in on recordings from the Kootenai Harvest Revival, we did leave last week's broadcast somewhat hanging. As was mentioned during that show last week, on November 3rd, the city of Nelson, BC was set to vote on a resolution introduced by the Genetically Engineered Free Kootenais campaign. In an October 20th presentation to the City Council, which we heard on that broadcast, the group requested that City Council adopt a resolution that would send a strong message that the municipality opposes the cultivation of genetically engineered plants and trees. And so, on the evening of November 3rd, 2008, the City of Nelson officially became Canada's third GE-free zone by way of a unanimous decision by all council members and the mayor. The decision is certainly a pinnacle to our GE Free Zones series here on the show that has, since the group first met in November 2007, been documenting the evolution of the campaign. While Nelson is only one of many local governments the group intends to approach, it is the first in the region and lays a solid foundation from which the group can work towards its ultimate goal of creating an entire region that can be and remain free of genetically engineered plants and trees. Now, Deconstructing Dinner did attend the November 3rd council meeting, and we'll listen to a clip of that in just a moment. But first of interest is yet another important event that took place prior to the vote by council. Here in British Columbia, residents will be heading to the polls on November 15th to elect local government representatives. The GE Free Kootenais campaign viewed the election as an opportunity to make genetically engineered food an election issue. And it appears that the strategy was successful, and in part thanks to one of the GE Free Kootenais members running as a candidate for Nelson City Council. Here's a clip of Nelson City Council candidate Kim Charlesworth addressing an all-candidates meeting on October 30th.
Some of the other ways that we can support agriculture and food security with the City of Nelson is by passing a resolution for the genetically engineered free zone in the City of Nelson. Both a symbolic and important in sending a message that we wish our food supply to be safe. This resolution was presented to City Council on October 20th by the GE Free Kootenais campaign, of which I'm a founding member.
Now keep in mind that all of the current councillors and mayor were witness to the very visible and vocal support for the campaign that you just heard. Certainly quite the boost to the campaign's chances to have the resolution voted on only a few days later. Also running for mayor is current councillor Gord McAdams, and he too made the GE Free Kootenais campaign an election issue.
Thanks. I'm going to focus on food security. My response to this question overlaps with my answer to the transportation, so the two are closely linked. Providing high-quality, locally produced food makes sense ecologically, environmentally, and socially. It is logical to give this issue high priority attention, and I have done that. Last November, I was pleased to be a facilitator at the Food Security Conference in Nelson. I have been a member of the GE Free Kootenai's working group, along with Kim, since its inception, and I have ensured that that issue is coming to council table next Monday night.
Now, Deconstructing Dinner was, of course, in attendance at the November 3rd council meeting alongside the group's steering committee and a few devoted supporters, including one person who raised up a sign in the back of the room that read, "Say no to GMO." Now, while the sound quality of this recording is not ideal, here's a brief sample of what it sounds like when local governments take action on genetically engineered food.
All right, so 5A is the genetically engineered free kootenai's proposal. And members of the genetic engineering free kootenai working group attended the committee of the whole meeting on October the 20th and requested that council pass a resolution of the city of Nelson to be free of genetically engineered plants and trees. So there were staff recommendations to request to support the resolution.
The motion I'd like to make is in that the city of Nelson does not support the cultivation of genetically engineered plants and trees in the municipality of Nelson. Further, the council will not purchase its own for its own operations GE plants and trees. The city of Nelson agrees to revisit this as pertinent new information becomes available that affects this resolution. And further, that the city of Nelson shall forward copies of the resolution to the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, UBCM, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, Health Canada, CropLife Canada, Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, local MLA and MP offices, and any interested and related groups for comment.
Now, for those of you who were unable to make out the dialogue there, that last voice was Councillor Gord McAdams reading the proposed GE-free resolution. Here again is the resolution Councillor McAdams read. Quote, "The City of Nelson does not support the cultivation of genetically engineered plants and trees in the municipality of Nelson, and further, that Council will not purchase for its own operations GE plants or trees. The City of Nelson agrees to revisit this as pertinent new information becomes available that affects this resolution, and further, that the City of Nelson shall forward copies of the resolution to the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, the Union of BC Municipalities, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, Health Canada, CropLife Canada, Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, local MLA and MP offices, and any interested and related groups for comment," end quote. Councillor McAdams continued by suggesting that the city's official community plan can help guide the council to address the issue of genetically engineered food. As was suggested in the proposed resolution by GE Free Kootenai's, Councillor McAdams recited the following goals from the city's official community plan. Number one, to maintain and enhance Nelson's environmental quality and to safeguard it for future generations. Number two, to ensure Nelson's economic stability and well-being by promoting environmentally sustainable economic development. And number three, to act locally toward the solution of regional, national, and global environmental problems. End quote. A small exchange among the mayor and councillors ensued whereby the proposed resolution was suggested as being similar to the bottled water and municipal pesticide bans that the city has enacted. And without any delay, the council voted.
Moved by Councillor McAdams. Seconded by Councillor Stacey.
Yes.
All in favor? Opposed? None. Carried. Thank you very much.
Again, the council voted unanimously to support the GE-free resolution, and while not legally binding, the policy now lays the framework for taking future action should the cultivation of genetically engineered plants and trees ever become a problem. The group will now work towards bringing other local governments in the region on board as they work towards their goal of creating a Kootenai region free of genetically engineered plants and trees. Another exciting initiative that Deconstructing Dinner has also been covering for quite some time is Canada's first community-supported agriculture project for grain, which is already providing an alternative to farmers in the Creston Valley to grow non-genetically engineered crops. Except for a slight shortfall in the expected yields, the first year of this innovative project has indeed been successful. In early September, the three farmers harvested their crop of red fife wheat, Khorasan wheat, hard spring wheat, spelt, and oats. And on October 26th, some of that grain even arrived in Nelson via sailboat, following a 56-hour journey on Kootenai Lake by a fleet of four sailboats. Now, more on that sailing journey will be shared on an upcoming broadcast, but first, we can track back to September 19th, 2008, when deconstructing dinner alongside the Nelson Creston Grain CSA and the All Seasons Cafe teamed up to host a weekend harvest celebration. Of course, the grain harvest is a rather monumental one, considering locally grown grains have not been commercially available in the region for decades. But more importantly, because the project may represent a promising future for a thriving local food system, not only for the region it serves, but perhaps for other communities in North America wishing to take on a similar initiative. The weekend was titled The Kootenai Harvest Revival and was made up of an evening of speakers and music, followed by a full day of tasting locally grown grains. Now, having been directly involved with the event, I can certainly suggest that the angle that we took in putting this event on is definitely one to recommend to other communities wishing to inspire the creation of a more local food system. On the first evening of the event, a series of speakers were invited to share a history of agriculture and food in the Kootenai regions of British Columbia. The hope was that through the exploration of what was once possible in the area, the event would help project what is currently possible to grow, process, and consume with respect to food. Certainly, the Grain CSA is one of those projects unearthing the potential of the region. Of course, community support and sponsorship is necessary to put on such an event, and alongside the support from Deconstructing Dinner, the event was made possible by the Columbia Basin Trust, Selkirk College, the All Seasons Cafe, the Nelson Creston Grain CSA, the Kootenai Country Store Cooperative, Kootenai Co-op Radio, the Kootenai Food Strategy Society, Hall Printing, the Nelson Daily News, Express Newspaper, Creston and District Museum, the Creston Food Action Coalition, West Kootenai Eco Society, and WildSite. Over the course of today's broadcast and next week's, you'll hear the voices of Capers Markets co-founder Russell Precious, author and Sinaiaxt Nation spokesperson Eileen Delahanty-Perks, spokesperson for the Dukabor people J.J. Verrigan, author and farmer Luann Armstrong, CSA farmers Keith Huscroft and Roy Lawrence, and CSA co-founder Matt Lowe. The evening event was attended by about 270 people at Nelson's Capitol Theater, and filling the back of the stage was a slideshow presentation of photographs that is available on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca, and that's listed under the episode titled The Kootenai Harvest Revival. Now, in this first clip from the evening event, you'll hear musician Bessie Wapp opening up the event. Bessie is followed by the MC for the evening, Russell Precious. Russell is the co-founder of Capers Markets, a successful chain of natural food stores in the Vancouver area. Russell also sits on the boards of the West Kootenai Eco Society and the Kootenai Country Store Cooperative.
I'm going to sing a 100-mile song. Small hands dig deep into pockets of earth, plant your seeds. Small hands dig deep into pockets of earth, plant your seeds. It's a fragile thing, it's a gallant thing, it's a song sung in the mowing. It's a deep breath, it's an earth sigh, it's a slowing. It's the thunder's distant rumble, it's the tremble of a new leaf. It's the sense of belonging to a vast yet tiny wonder. Small hands dig deep into pockets of earth, plant your seeds. Small hands dig deep into pockets of earth, plant your seeds. Can you hear small but clear grow. Thank you. It's a fragile thing, it's a gallant thing, it's a song sung in the mowing. It's a deep breath, it's an earth sigh, it's a slow oh 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 wing. Small hands dig deep into pockets of earth, plant your seeds. Small hands dig deep into pockets of earth, plant your seeds. Seedling, oh, have no fear, you're not alone down here.
Thank you.
That was the song I'd hoped would go on forever. Thank you, Bessie. Bessie will be playing for us again later. And welcome, everyone, to the Kootenai Harvest recital. Revival. I've already been asked, is this a revival meeting? To which I said I had already checked the dictionary, and the word revival has several meanings. And, of course, the meaning that applies this evening is that we are uncovering or rediscovering something that has been lost. But let me tell you how this event came to be in the first place. Many of you will recall, several years ago, two springs ago, in fact, when the 100-mile diet just sort of took off. It's one of those books that just goes, it's a sleeper, just sort of overnight, everybody embraces it. It's a book, a message whose time has come. And out of the 100-mile diet, Community Food Matters here issued the Eat Local Challenge. That was for the month of August last summer. And my friend and colleague Matt Lowe took up the Eat Local Challenge and quickly determined that to his woe, the big challenge in this community was a lack of grain. There was no grain being grown within 100 miles for consumption here. So, not being one to miss a good meal, Matt got together, so visited various Creston farmers, and started the first CSA. CSA is Community Supported Agriculture, the first CSA grain initiative in Canada. CSAs as a format for supporting local agriculture had been used many times in the world of fruit and vegetables, but never before for grains. So together with 180 participants and one local restaurant, Asselet Levant, 200 shares were sold for $100 each, which guaranteed that, well, didn't guarantee, but suggested that people would receive 100 pounds of grain at the end of this season. The way a CSA works, and the benefits, of course, are that a farmer knows in advance the amount to plant. The farmer is paid in advance, so it takes some of the guesswork out of farming. So 2 weeks ago, Matt and myself and Andre Peaver toured these farms. There I am standing in a field somewhere in the Creston Valley. And it was just totally moving to be on the farms with the farmers, harvesting grain in the field, chewing on it, just talking about the different types of grain. Three farmers signed on to grow grains. And this season, there were two types of wheat. Corazon, which is better known as Kamut, which is the trade name, and oats and spelt and even some lentils were grown. That was one strand that led to this evening. The other strand was this spring in April and May, the Kootenai Co-op presented a series of four food events, four films, and at one of those events, the new owners of the All Seasons Cafe, Paul and Julia, were very excited about what they heard. And John Steinman, who was officiating at those events, they approached him and said, listen, we would really like to do a food benefit for the local food agriculture. So John and Matt and Paul and Julia started exploring the possibility of doing a food benefit at the All Seasons Cafe. By the time they had finished, the event had grown from an evening event at the All Seasons Cafe to a brunch and evening event at the All Seasons Cafe, and then it was clear there just wasn't enough time or space to tell the story of the history of food in the Kootenays in that evening while we were trying to eat, so that morphed into the event which is happening this evening. So we're going to celebrate local agriculture and local culture. We're going to celebrate it in storytelling. We're going to celebrate it in song. And we're going to celebrate it in a remarkable selection of images. It's a funny thing, you know. There's a crisis in the world in terms of food production. We haven't felt it a whole lot here yet, maybe in slightly rising food prices. But when there's a crisis in agriculture, there's inevitably a crisis in culture. So this is the turning point. There's been a steady shift in the last 2 years from a focus in organics to a focus in local. Cultural anthropologists, of course, have always been aware that food is a core determinant of any given culture. Yet in the West, you know, industrial agriculture took the culture out of agriculture, just as the assembly line had taken the art out of craftsmanship. The shift to local agriculture for many years has been somewhat quaint and whimsical, but in these times it is now changing to something that is much more demanding. And I think if we've seen this week the gyrations in the global economy seems to mark the changes that are now upon us. There's a very long and rich agricultural tradition here in the Kootenays, and we have a great selection of people tonight who are going to tell that story.
Russell Precious speaking on September 19th, 2008 at the Kootenay Harvest Revival in Nelson, British Columbia. This is Deconstructing Dinner. If you are just tuning in, there is a slideshow of photographs available on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Those photographs accompanied the speakers at the event. But the first speaker of the evening brought her own slideshow of images, and while it's not imperative to view them while listening to her talk, it's no doubt recommended. And so if you do have internet access, you can access the PowerPoint presentation of Eileen Delahanty-Perks by linking to it from the November 6th, 2008 broadcast posted on our site. Again, the site is deconstructingdinner.ca. Eileen Delahanty-Perks is an author and historian who, among her many essays and articles, authored the book The Geography of Memory, Recovering Stories of a Landscape's First People. Here again is MC Russell Precious introducing Eileen.
So, to begin, I loved it in history and when we were taught in 1492 that Christopher Columbus discovered America. They didn't tell us that there were likely 50 million native people living in the Americas when Christopher Columbus came. I can't imagine how exciting it was to be discovered by Christopher Columbus. In the Kootenays, this region where white settlers have really only been here for about 150 years, the native peoples had been here for nearly 13,000 years. Eileen Delahanty-Perks is with us this evening. I had a lovely meeting with Eileen this week, and I was so moved by her deep connection to place and its impact on culture, to place and its impact on how we think and how we feel. Please welcome Eileen Delahanty-Perks.
Thank you, Russell. By way of beginning, it falls to me a great honor and privilege to speak for the Sinaiks people tonight in welcoming you to their territory. I am not a Sinaiks person, but I've been given their blessing to extend to you that welcome. And it's my honor and privilege to work with these people, to work with their story, which has such great integrity. The Sinaiks people were declared extinct by the federal government in 1956, despite the fact that they continued to exist, both in Canada and in the United States. It's the work for all of us locally to pay attention to and to honor their presence, even when it is quite latent. And I'd like us to take a moment right now before we begin to celebrate local culture, to honor in silence the memory of the ancestors of the Saint Ives people and the contemporary Saint Ives people who can't be here with us tonight. Thank you. I was asked about 6 months ago to put together some remarks for a food sustainability mini-conference that was held here with some Aboriginal people. And so I did what I do, which is to work with the cultural material of these people and put something together that's accessible to a larger group. So it was a great fun to receive a call and ask for something to be presented to you tonight, and I'm happy to present from Caribou to Camas, which is a survey, a seasonal survey of the Saint Ives people's diet and hunting and gathering practices. I want to emphasize that the Saint Ives people were not agricultural people. I know this is primarily an evening to celebrate agriculture. The Saint Ives were pre-agricultural people who hunted and gathered just as the landscape presented itself to them. Next slide. Early spring, any of you who've taken a walk up Pulpit Rock at the right time of year have seen the glacier lilies blooming in the rocky hillsides higher up. The glacier lily, the corm of the glacier lily, was a very important early first fresh food for the Saint Ives people that was harvested right after the snow had pulled back. They dug up the corms and they ate them fresh or cooked or dried and then cooked later on. Next slide. The false Solomon seal came next. You see it coming up, these little fingers of green all unfurling. It's very common even in woodland areas right here in Nelson. The false Solomon seal was an important rhizome plant. They would dig up the underneath the soil, and they would eat both the new shoots that come out above the ground and the little shallow roots that carry on all around the plant. They did not eat the berries, which a lot of you might recognize and see, but they did eat the new shoots. I've steamed them and eaten them. They're delicious. They taste like Kootenai asparagus. Next slide. The bear was a very important food for the Saint Ives people. They were rare among interior Salish tribes in that they did consume bear. It was not a common thing for the interior Salish tribes to eat bear. The Saint Ives relished bear meat, and they were known to drag bears out of hibernation in order to consume the meat. For the Saint Ives, the bear was an animal and still is an animal of great power. The mountain goat was also a very important animal food for the Saint Ives people. They would hunt the mountain goat in the spring, and they would often use a series of long poles to chase the mountain goat out to the edge of a cliff and then just sort of nudge it off down the cliff. And that was how they hunted the mountain goat. A very important cultural plant or animal. Next slide, please. A very important cultural animal for the Saint Ives people. My book, The Geography of Memory, details a story about self-esteem and the building of self-esteem, which was taught to young children through the story of mountain goat and the origin of the huckleberry plant. The women harvested the hair of the huckleberry. Sorry, not the hair of the huckleberry, of the mountain. Yes, that huckleberry hair. The hair of the mountain goat, and they wove the hair, they spun it and wove it into very warm cloth that they used, almost like a wool. It was also an important emblem for the Saint Ives people. The tribal people had a mountain goat skull on the top of a pole that was often a very significant centerpiece for their feasting and dancing. Next slide, please. Okay, this is the camas. I don't know, have anybody seen camas growing in where they live locally? I've been collecting anecdotal observations about this plant. It really annoys me that the Plants of the Southern Interior does not list this plant in its guidebook. This was an important sustaining food for the Saint Ives people. The This food really likes, the camas really likes the sort of a semi-wetland environment. It likes wet ditches and things like that. And we've destroyed a lot of those wet areas through the reservoir planning that we've done with our valleys, but it's great to know that it's still growing in the Slocan Valley. Very important food. Next slide. This is what the camas looks like once it's been dug up. The root has been dug up and peeled and dried. And it takes hours and hours and hours of preparation that still boggle my mind, that these women continually to this day have the patience to undertake the work of the wild plant food preservation. Next slide. This is the bitterroot. Has anybody seen the bitterroot growing anywhere in Castlegar area, maybe? I would pay a lot of money if I could get somebody to let me know that they had seen it growing. The bitterroot is, again, a very important plant food. I suspect it did grow at one time in isolated patches, especially right around between Castlegar and Trail and on south toward the border. I'm not positive of that, though, and I do know that it was a very important trade food item. Anybody who's tasted bitterroot knows it is good to its name, very bitter, but also treasured by the Aboriginal people as a plant food. Next slide. The cow parsnip, this is a really accessible thing for any of us to just go out and cut off a stalk and chew into it like celery. It grows widely all through the Cottonwood Valley here south of Nelson. I'm sure it's in lots of patches in the Slocan Valley as well. And it's a very accessible thing to approach and experiment with eating, especially since you're not digging up a root, you're just taking a stalk off of it. It's easy to experiment with the cow parsnip. Next slide. The Indian potato, also known locally as the spring beauty, is another underground root or corm food. The Sinaiks call all these plants that come underground, they call all of them roots, whether they're a corm, a rhizome, whatever the technical term is for them, they call them roots. Next slide. So yeah, so now it's, you know, getting on towards summer, and the fishing opportunities are starting to really pick up. This is a gorgeous shot of a bull trout, actually, with a rainbow prey in its mouth. You can see that there. And the bull trout, of course, is in many ways, the totem fish for the Sinaiks people. Their name, Sinaiks, is derived from the name for the bull trout, which is Aikst. Because of climate change combined with reservoir construction, the bull trout is really threatened in this area now. It likes cool mountain streams, and there seem to be less and less of those. Next slide. The ponderosa pine, a really important sustaining food for the Aboriginal people. They would, in June, harvest the cambium layer. Just underneath the outer bark is a layer of kind of more living and luscious bark, the inner bark, the cambium, and that would be harvested from a tree that was not fully mature like this one, but sort of more 10 to 20 years old, 30 years old maybe, and they would harvest the cambium off of it in strips. I don't know how many of you used to tie up licorice into knots and then bite the knot off. Anybody ever do that? I was delighted to learn that the Sinaiks used to do this with the cambium. They would pull off strips, tie them into knots, and then bite off at the knot just the way we used to eat licorice. So there you have it, Sinaiks licorice. Next slide. Oh yeah, the sustaining salmon. If you look at maps of the permanent village sites for the Sinaiks people, they follow the path of the salmon as it came up the Columbia River, turned up the Slocan Valley, proceeded up the Arrow Lakes Valley, all the way to the Big Bend, back around as far as Windermere. The salmon were really, really important. The Grand Coulee Dam, constructed in 1941, or completed then, completely eliminated the salmon. They extirpated the salmon from our region. It's hard to even describe to you the impact that had culturally on the people and that it's had on the biosphere that we call this area. Very, very significant plant or animal food, and it's gone now for good. Next slide. So coyote, they didn't eat coyotes. They wouldn't have dared because coyote is kind of a fierce and unreliable creature in many ways, and very important deity for the Sinaix people. The Kootenai Mountain Culture magazine will be running a story in the winter issue coming out very soon that features a part of a tale told by Marilyn James, interpreted with cultural information around it by me. And I won't spend a lot of time on Coyote right now, but I encourage you to seek out that article because there's some good things in there. Coyote did largely control the path of the salmon. He brought the salmon up the Columbia River himself. And the salmon came very briefly in three separate runs. The Chinook arrived in June. They were the big ones, 50 to 100 pounds. And then there was, after the Chinook, there was the sockeye, which was also quite a large run, but a smaller fish. And finally, in October, came the coho. So you had those three different sets of salmon, and they were very, very important. Next slide. The preservation of salmon was essential to survival. There were many taboos associated with preservation, with fishing. Nobody wanted to mess around with whether or not the salmon were going to come home in great numbers. So there was a lot of attention paid to the sanctity of food preservation, in particular the salmon. The salmon were dried in very large quantity in sort of mat-covered A-frame structures that were a feature at any major fishery. There would have been one at the mouth of the Slocan River and also one down at Kettle Falls. Next slide. So this is the tiger lily. I didn't want to mistake it with the glacier lily. I sometimes do. The tiger lily is a wonderful plant that blooms in June, really more like July. I understand that it's quite threatened. The populations of this plant are down, so I want to just suggest to you that that you not touch any tiger lilies that you see. Leave them alone. I have been told recently by someone that tiger lilies really like to come back after fire. And the Sinaix did burn to cultivate tiger lily and huckleberry. And maybe it's because of fire suppression that we have so many fewer of them. I have been told, I have not tried the root, but I've been told it's exceptionally bitter. So I'm not sure we're missing much. Next slide. Yeah, this is the thimbleberry. The wild strawberry. They look so much alike. This is the wild strawberry, little teeny tiny, growing in the woods there. You've seen them. Next slide. The sopalali, or the swissum berry, a really important berry to the Sinaix and other interior Salish tribes to this day. Take a good look at it and learn to recognize it. When you come across a bush, give yourself a treat. It is a bittersweet berry. Some people's palates reject it. I have learned to love them, and nothing makes me happier than to find a bush ready to pick. And then we have the thimbleberry, which is a super important plant food. And the thimbleberry was really appreciated deeply by the Sinaix, I think because they ripen one at a time. You all have seen that, how you can't go to a patch and get them all at once, right? The Sinaix found that, I think, quite endearing as a plant, and they treasured the thimbleberry, something that we ignore. And then, of course, the queen of all the fruits, or the king, or the chief, however you want to say it, the chief of all the fruiting plants was the huckleberry, and we all know why. So summer's pretty much over, and the berries are picked, and it's time to turn back to the streams again, and we see there the kokanee. Actually, kikanee is an interior Salish Sinaix word, which means redfish or kokanee. It's derived directly from that word that they developed over time. It's ironic to me, in a way, you know, when you think about it, these local sustaining foods of theirs. How many people have been to the streams to catch any kokanee this month? It's just not really done anymore, and we certainly don't pick up the spawners in any event. We fish out of a deeper lake. But they were at the stream side, and they were picking up the spawning kokanee. The mountain caribou, I can't say enough about the importance of the mountain caribou for the Sinaix people. The mountain caribou sustained itself on sedge and tree lichen. Both of these things, the tree lichen threatened by logging practices, the sedge threatened by reservoir systems. This caribou was once like the plains buffalo here, and it's now nearly extirpated from the region. Next slide. I just want to run through a couple of principles and protocols of food gathering. Any of you who want to undertake some wild plant food gathering, it's really important to consider some of these things. First of all, it's really, really important to recognize the plant or the animal that you are engaged in using as food by making an offering to that plant or animal of any kind. It can just be a simple verbal or nonverbal thought offering. It was really important in Sinaist traditional culture to have a rotation of harvest years and management of areas by families. They practiced sustainability before we knew what that was, and they survived here for several thousand years as a result of that. So if you are out gathering, think about sustainability. It's very different from agriculture, which is about harvesting everything. Again, partial harvest. Gratitude is also very important. Without gratitude, the Sinaiks believe there could be no abundance, and they were very, very clear on that then in the old traditional times, as they still are. And there was always respect for life, so that after a family death, there was no gathering, and a woman during her moon time would not gather and touch plant foods. Care and cleanliness was also really important, and waste was frowned upon, as you can imagine, sustaining their lives here in this rugged landscape. They needed every berry they could get. And finally, generosity, a very important principle for them. I see this to this day when I work with Native people. They are exceptionally generous, the most generous people I have ever met, even though most of them are living at or near or below the poverty line. They are very generous with everything that they have, and I always feel it's a great privilege to be in contact with that. And they believed that the earth was generous to them. Thank you.
Eileen Delahanty-Perks speaking in September 2008 at the Kootenai Harvest Revival in Nelson, British Columbia. This is Deconstructing Dinner. On today's and next week's broadcast, we'll be listening in on recordings from the Kootenai Harvest Revival held in Nelson to celebrate the harvest of grain from Canada's first community-supported agriculture project, 4Grain. We've been covering the evolution of that project since its conception in late summer 2007 as part of our Local Grain Revolution series. Because of the show's involvement with the CSA, Deconstructing Dinner teamed up with CSA co-founder Matt Lowe and a local restaurant to host a celebratory harvest event that would also act as a catalyst for what was billed as a local food revolution. It was decided that through the revisiting of the region's food production history, that residents, businesses, and local organizations could be inspired to become part of a movement to reclaim that heritage of food production, which throughout most North American regions is not so different from the one that the Kootenai Harvest Revival was unearthing. Moving on from the history of the region's native inhabitants, one of the first groups of white settlers into the Kootenai region of BC were the Doukhobors, a spiritual Christian sect of Russian origin who, beginning in the 18th century, rejected secular government, the Russian Orthodox priests, icons, all church ritual, the Bible as the supreme source of divine revelation, and the divinity of Jesus. Their pacifist beliefs and desire to avoid government interference in their life led to an exodus of the majority of the group from the Russian Empire to Canada at the close of the 19th century. Most of them settled in Saskatchewan before moving to British Columbia, and it's estimated that about 15,000 Doukhobors continue to live in Western Canada and of 5,000 in the United States. With Doukhobors maintaining a rich history of living off the land, J.J. Varigan was invited to share the Doukhobor story. J.J. is the great-grandson of Peter Varigan, who was the Doukhobors' spiritual leader when they arrived in Canada in the early 20th century. There are some remarkable photos of Doukhobor culture displayed during J.J.'s talk, and those are posted on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the November 6th, 2008 broadcast. And here again is MC Russell Precious.
So this evening, it's just my total pleasure to welcome J.J. Varigan, who is presently resides in Grand Forks and is Executive Director of the Union of Spiritual Communities of Christ. It was fun for me to discover that the word Doukhobor translates as spirit wrestlers. And I suspect that when many of us came here to the Kootenais in the 70s as war resistors or back to the landers, we could certainly relate, because I think we felt that we were spirit wrestlers ourselves. Please give J.J. Varigan a very warm welcome to be with us this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Russell, and thank you very much, Eileen, for starting tonight's evening in the manner that it should be started, paying respect to the original people that walked this land. And I say this because when we're talking about agriculture and talking about the relationship of human beings to the land that we walk, we can't forget the human element as well. And we have much to learn from our Aboriginal brothers and sisters. The dislocation happening in our society, whether we're talking about climate change, whether we're talking about peak oil, whether we're talking about food security. Just driving up here, listening to the news, saddened to hear about what's happening with the sales of milk in China. And the fact that in order to increase their profit margin, they seem to be putting the same kind of things that people make cabinet countertops out of into the milk that they sell to their children. I've been asked here to come and speak about the history of the Dukawar people with respect to agriculture in the Kootenai boundary, but primarily focusing on the boundary area. And again, I just want to go back when Russell was giving us the definition of revival. And I think it's important for us, just as our Aboriginal brothers and sisters, to recognize that the spiritual connection between us as human beings and the planet that sustains us. Russian tradition, not only Dukhobor tradition, is steeped in that understanding. I'm not sure if any of you folks know papirosy, those cigarettes that Stalin used to smoke with about 2 inches of tobacco and about a 3-inch filter. On the cover of the box of these papirosy, and they've been sold for years and years in Soviet Union, Russia, there's three. They look like knights, and they represent different things. One is the defender of the people. Another one represents the merchant trader class, and one represents the tillers of the soil. And so, again, just to make that connection between culture and agriculture, our people came here to Canada with the assistance of Leo Tolstoy, and I just want to read you a quote from him. One of the primary and generally recognized requirements to happiness is man's communion with nature, such as living under an open sky when he can see the light of the sun and breathe fresh air, live close to the earth, plants and animals. Deprivation of this has always been looked upon as a great misfortune. Not too many people understand Tolstoy in those terms. When our people came to Saskatchewan, they had to adapt to the new environment that they found themselves in, climate-wise, people-wise, land-wise. And they were not strangers to this. In fact, because of their exile throughout the Russian Empire, because of their spiritual beliefs, because of their pacifism, they adapted to the land wherever they went. When they were exiled throughout the Russian Empire to the Crimea, which had a good climate. They grew their gardens. They lived in villages. This was before they embarked on a communal enterprise here in Canada. Afterwards, when they were exiled to Georgia, because they were exiled to a place 6,000 feet above sea level, they couldn't grow wheat, and so they grew barley to use for flour. They grew, in Siberia, they grew rye. And so when they came over to Canada and they settled in the prairies initially, they also started to break the land. And then because of the difficulties over the government with respect to private land ownership, because they did not believe in ownership of the land, similar to other cultures, they were given an ultimatum, either taking out individual parcels and swearing oaths of allegiance or surrendering their property. And so basically they left almost 240,000 acres of land in the prairies that they were not compensated for and came to BC. Here they bought land with borrowed money. And again, being from a different culture, being strangers to this land, unfortunately, there were clashes with our First Nations people. And again, that just brings me back to the present. When we are looking at resurrecting or reviving agriculture, it's not only the natural environment that we have to be careful of, sensitive to, we also cannot forget the human environment so that we don't create obstructions for ourselves so that what we do can be an example. And the world sorely needs those kinds of examples. When our people came here to the Kootenai boundary, they sent men work parties. And that was in 1908 to 1911 was when the migration happened. And initially, these clearing parties, these initial parties came and they cleared the land, taking down trees. In Grand Forks, they purchased over 4,000 acres of land. Up the North Fork, which I'm not sure if you folks around here are familiar with, somebody was telling me that they had produced over 10,000 cedar poles for sale. And this is the way that they financed their agricultural development. Later on in the year, women and children started to arrive. And I think by 1910, there was almost, or 1909, I'm sorry, there was almost 1,000 people that made the trip from the prairies to the Kootenai boundary. And there were almost 24 villages established in the Grand Forks area. These villages basically were their own entities. And I guess I have to say one thing so that people have a clear understanding of how our people were able to become engaged in such a, on a massive scale in agriculture, is because these villages contained maybe 50 people. They were primarily family-based units. They lived, worked communally, and they were following the guidance of their leader at that time, Peter Lordly Verrigan. Verrigan had spent time in exile in Siberia, where he also had opportunity to experiment with different types of agriculture. And he used his lessons learned there when he came to Canada and applied them here. And so when you have, unlike today's farmers that maybe don't have that much land, that have to develop it on their own, when you have 5,000 people attending on a survival basis to their needs, you don't always have to have countless meetings to figure out what you're going to do. And so at that time, they were able to plant crops that did the best in the environment that they were cultivated in. For example, the slopes in Spencer Hill with respect to orchards, 50,000 fruit trees planted throughout the area, and also in the Kootenais. In fact, to prepare the land for planting, I was told even that they had to bring soil from Pass Creek to Uchushenya, including clover and other growths, so that after it would grow and it would be plowed over, the soil would be okay for planting. So they did that. They planted different crops in where the terrain was most productive. In terms of processing it, they also built their own mills, canning factories, where they processed the food, and not only food, but processed flax to make clothing, basically self-sufficient. Another interesting thing that they had was they had identified just like areas and lands where things could be grown better. Our people also had individuals that were particularly skillful at managing various crops. There was a McCordiff family that was specific, and not only the zebras, but McCordiff's to making honey. My Zibbons with respect to, I think, cherries, I believe. And so they were able to do all of that because it was a matter of survival. They wasted very little. In fact, when they were harvesting grain, kids would walk behind the machines to pick up grain so that nothing would be left or lost. And they became very successful, maybe to the chagrin of some of their own fellow believers. Some of our Dukwuar people, for example, felt that horses could be not harnessed because they were also our brothers and sisters, and it wasn't fair. And so within the community, there were difficulties that ultimately undermined the communal enterprise. And of course, outside of the community, there were also difficulties, and this is where we get into the human element again. Even though our people were pacifists, and they during World War I, they even sent carloads of their preserves to families of serving people that were serving on the front. They also adopted a diet in order to also show that austerity, that solidarity with the surrounding public. Unfortunately, this all happened in the background of 1917, the Russian Revolution, when they were working communally. The powers that were could not distinguish communalism from communism, and because of a lot of different forces, that all that ultimately and unfortunately came to an end in terms of this large communal exercise in agriculture, and it wasn't restricted to agriculture. People are saying, what now? I wish I could say to you honestly that our Dukhobor people were still people that had their fingers in the soil. In all honesty, I can't. We have become, like so many of us, disconnected from the soil, sometimes even disconnected from each other. That's the bad news. The good news is that we have people in our midst, and I'd like to acknowledge a couple of them here tonight, Walter and Vera Kanigan, that have started community gardens, that are encouraging our young people to return to the land. The other good news is that we do have land, our USCC organization, suitable for agriculture, that we are looking to work in partnership with others to bring it back to its full potential. Many Dukhobors of my generation are more used to receiving care packages from their parents when they're living in the city than growing things themselves. As I say, the good news is that that is changing. In closing, I want to just again express my appreciation for those of you that are returning back to the land. Life is not a one-way street. As much as we can learn from our Aboriginal brothers and sisters, our Dukhobor brothers and sisters, there's a lot that we can also learn from you. I'd just like to close, I guess, by translating a song that Peter Lordly composed that reflects our attitude to creation. Lord, you are the light of my life. I wish to honor you always. You have created me out of the land and gave me a soul of understanding. I look at the beauty of the structure of the beauty of creation, and it takes me to ecstasy. In nature, I see immense power, and it also honors you, our Creator. And like the stars shine in the skies, it seems they are calling all of us to a life of peace, brotherhood, and sisterhood. Our hope as Dukhobors is that we, all of us, fully develop that special relationship that we have to the earth that we walk on and to those that we share this pilgrimage with. Thank you very much.
J.J. Varigan speaking in September 2008 in Nelson, British Columbia. J.J. is the executive director of the Union of Spiritual Communities of Christ and lives in Grand Forks, British Columbia. You can learn more about the Dukhobor people by exploring some of the links on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and listed under the November 6th, 2008 broadcast. On next week's broadcast, you can expect more recordings from the Kootenai Harvest Revival, including author and farmer Luann Armstrong and farmer Keith Huscroft, both highly recommended recordings to look forward to. And you can also expect some more music from the event, including Earl Hamilton's Close to Home, a piece he authored specifically for the Harvest Revival, and another piece by Bessie Wapp. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250 352-9600.